The Tom Woods Show, episode 929.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, we are inching toward the 1,000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, and I'd like you to join me for it at a special event in Orlando, September 9th, featuring Michael Malice and Tom DiLorenzo as special guests, and the great Eric July as MC. It's absolutely free, but you gotta register. Check it out at tomwoods.com/Orlando. All right, everybody, it was bound to happen. Michael Malice now has his own program. That's right, it's called You're Welcome with Michael Malice, airs live 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time every Wednesday over at compoundmedia.com. I've got the details up at tomwoods.com/929. It's just great. I was his first guest. I was his first guest. I was in studio with him because I happened to be in New York the very week that he was launching the show. Crazy coincidence. So I went in and we did the first episode together. That's what I'm going to share with you today. So I hope you like it. I hope you do not correct his grammar. Obviously, somebody of Michael Malice's intelligence knows how to spell "you're welcome," so don't do that. But anyway, we cover all kinds of great topics on this show, and Michael's a wonderful host, and I really enjoyed myself, and I hope you will enjoy it too. So here it is.
Hello, Tom.
Michael, always fun.
So I'm a frequent guest on Tom's show. Which you can see at tomwoods.com. It's a daily podcast, very, very popular. I was voted the most popular guest on your show ahead of such dopes as Ron Paul, whoever he is. And coincidentally, you know, God works in mysterious ways, a girl by the name of Jessie was the one who introduced us. She recommended that I be on your show, and today's her birthday.
Oh, how about that?
Happy birthday to Jessie, wherever she is.
Right. We should give her a hearty congratulations.
Absolutely.
On that.
So 60 years young. So I had a lot of questions for you from Twitter, but you've written 12 books. Is it 12?
It is, yeah.
12 books, host of the Tom Woods podcast. You're a senior fellow at the Mises Institute. One of the books that you've written, I think that's kind of your claim to fame, was The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. What do you think, if I had to ask you, the biggest misconception people have, what they're taught about American history, what would that be?
Oh, man, it's hard to narrow it down. I mean, because the overall, the big picture.
Okay, you want to give us three?
Yeah, how about if I give you three? Is that okay?
Yeah.
And by the way, this is such a brand new show. Am I looking at you? Am I looking over
here? Look at me.
All right, I might as well look at you. Yeah. Why not?
It's with the best view.
All right, I think there are basically three. Number one that I got in junior high, which was big business just exploits people and is a parasite on society and has nothing to show for itself. You'd have to be a terrible exploiter if you support any of the businessmen of the 19th century because they took advantage of consumers and workers and everything else. Second thing would be Franklin Roosevelt got us out of the Great Depression. Everybody believes this, or they think World War II got us out of the Great Depression. If you believe that, you have thereby justified every stimulus program ever. And then thirdly, that political decentralization is supported only by people who favor slavery. If you want secession or anything like that, you probably secretly favor slavery because that's the only reason it's ever been invoked in American history.
I'm shocked that you didn't put on your list the idea that the Civil War was about slavery primarily.
Well, there because I think most professional historians will concede that.
Okay.
But, I mean, all you have to do is read Lincoln's first inaugural. You don't have to find some obscure source tucked away in a desk drawer somewhere. I mean, Lincoln came right out and said, I have no intention to interfere with slavery where it exists. So he did say that. And it was not a war aim for at least the first year and a half of the war. So I think that's – but, of course, the general public doesn't know that. The general public thinks Lincoln was struck, overwhelmed with concern for the suffering black man. But then you actually look closely at what Lincoln believed, and he sounds more like the Ku Klux Klan than the NAACP in terms of his racial views. And we know that he was looking, we now know, all the way to the end of his presidency for a place to resettle the freed blacks somewhere else in the world, or maybe somewhere in the U.S., but tucked away from the rest of society. That's definitely not the Lincoln the average person is aware of, even if historians will grudgingly concede it.
So, but I don't understand. I thought World War II came when we had full employment and therefore the Depression was over.
Yeah, I mean, of course, superficially you think that would be the case, right? Because you just put people to work and that's got to solve it. But if that were the case, then the best way to solve economic problems would be to just start bombing our cities, or having the Japanese fleet and the U.S. fleet go out in the Pacific and just sink themselves to the bottom of the ocean. And then we'd say, think of how prosperous we are. Of course, all this is just simply a waste of resources. And moreover, if we look at the statistics like on GDP and stuff, the GDP figures for the war really are great. You have tremendous economic growth. But then you have to look and ask yourself, do these figures make any sense? This is at a time when the prime workers in the whole economy have now been sent overseas to fight. These are the people with the experience, with the physical brawn, with the know-how. All these people are gone. In their place are women with no experience, older men without the physical capabilities, and extremely young people. And you're going to tell me with this sudden and abrupt resource constraint, we're setting growth records? Obviously, there's something wrong with the numbers. So I've, some of my work, tried to explain why this is.
What is wrong with the numbers? Don't leave us hanging.
Well, what's wrong with the numbers is, for one thing, they're counting government expenditure as if it's the same thing as voluntary expenditures. So that's how you argue that the Soviet Union had tremendous growth, because look at how much concrete they produced and stuff. But did the economy, like, for example, even in the 1980s, I'm sure the Soviet Union could boast about how much concrete they were creating. But if you look at the standard of living of the people, they had 150,000 personal computers at a time when Americans had 25 million. So the numbers are concealing what's really important, which is, what is the standard of living of the public? And of course, they're suffering during the war. There's rationing. There are shortages of everything.
The draft.
People are getting shot at and killed. Yeah. This is not an improvement in your standard of living.
Actually, what's really funny is I had to do a high school debate about colonialism, and one of the few things I remember is Afghanistan, which was one of two countries that wasn't colonized, their biggest export was concrete in the 80s.
Oh, how about
that? That's a very coincidental thing that you said. So we got a bunch of questions for you. We're going to be taking calls in a bit at 877-962-6846. But the first question, the most important question is, is a hot dog considered a sandwich?
No. And yet I have no reason to say that. It's got bread and it's got meat.
Sui
generis.
Because it doesn't have two openings.
But if you,
I agree with you. But if you, I agree with you.
But if you accidentally tear that bottom part, does it become a sandwich?
No. That's not how classification works. I'm glad we're agreed on the same page. Here's something where we disagreed about. Tom and I had this great debate about Hamilton. He cleaned my clock. I didn't, although in all fairness, as I'm sure you agree, I didn't do as good a job as I could have because I blew my timing. But you definitely cleaned my clock. This was at the Junto.
Of course, that is part of the whole debate thing, is managing your time properly. But go ahead.
Correct. That is true. Yeah. I absolutely blew it. I made that point in advance, and it was a really great moment because I had Heather Woods, Tom, she showed up, and he didn't know she was coming, and then she the look on his face was...
She flew in from Kansas to New York without my knowledge.
To sit in my corner.
To sit in your corner.
But it still didn't work. So the question I have is, libertarians like yourself, Ron Paul was very big on this, are big on ending the Fed. Why, can you tell me in 90 seconds why the Federal Reserve is such a big deal and why people should care? Because most people don't even know what it is.
No, they don't. So there'd be two major things that if I had 90 seconds, so starting now. First one would be, if we had a private entity, and no, the Federal Reserve is not a private institution. So all the people who are worried about that, it is not private. It's a weird public-private kind of mishmash.
If it was private, you wouldn't have to have Janet Yellen.
Exactly. Yeah, you wouldn't have the Congress appointing it, creating it, sustaining it, giving it monopoly powers. But if we had had a private entity in charge of the U.S. money supply for 100 years and it had lost 95% of its value, we'd never hear the end of it. Oh my gosh, this thing is destruction personified. But when it's a government-created agency, well, they're nobody's perfect. You get all these excuses for it. The second thing is, and so in other words, the reason you can't just pile up green pieces of paper to retire on is that you know that in 30 years that pile will be worth one-third of what it is now. Whereas in the old days, you could pile up, when gold and silver circulated as money, you could pile up those coins and they would hold their value through your retirement. But secondly, why does the economy, this is the key thing, why does the economy move in this sine wave where, you know, we're up, we're down, we're up, we're down? Even there are some right-wing economists who say, well, you know, got to take the good and the bad with capitalism. But what the Austrians have said about the Fed is that the Fed, by playing around with interest rates, it puts the economy on these artificial highs that yeah, there's some prosperity there, but some of it's fake. And eventually the economy kind of catches up with this trickery because you can't, you know, you can't really become physically fit by just drinking energy drinks. I mean, you get a brief burst of energy and then you crash. Well, same goes with the economy. So why do we have the Great Depression? Why do we have these cycles? It's because of the Fed. I think that's important.
But we had booms and busts before the Fed existed.
We did indeed. And I have a talk I gave at the Mises Institute talking about them. But even there, the same phenomenon that the Fed has just blown up to the nth degree is at work, is artificial credit creation that is made partially possible by federal government subsidies and various special privileges, creating more credit than there is savings to back it up. And so it leads to more projects being started than can be profitably finished. In other words, it gets the economy into a configuration that can't continue that way. And so we don't want that. We just want sound money.
Here's what I love is when people first encounter like libertarian ideas, they have these questions off the top of their head and they think no one's ever heard them before. And they're right, these gotcha questions. Yeah. And the classic example of this is lighthouses, right? So they thought, well, if you didn't have the government running lighthouses, then you wouldn't have lighthouses and all these ships would be wrecking. And this example would be used in textbooks as the classic example of a public good
right.
that you have to have the government do until someone did their homework and found out that lighthouses were actually private.
Yeah, Ronald Coase had an article on lighthouses specifically where he showed that you just, as with a lot of these so-called public goods, you just bundle them in to other things.
Right.
In the same way that in a hotel, you don't pay separately for elevator service. It's included in the fee. Well, likewise, there'd be docking fees, and that would include the maintenance for the lighthouse. I mean, it would have taken you 10 seconds to figure out how the market could handle
lighthouses. You didn't even need to have 10 seconds. You could just go online.
Yeah, look at them.
Yeah.
Here's photographs of lighthouses.
Right.
Read Ronald Coase's article.
So here's the gotcha question I really love, which is, well, if you had a free economy, wouldn't people just be selling their organs to each other?
Okay.
So checkmate.
Because they'd be poor or because they'd be free to do it?
Because, well, both. So basically this would be the rich exploiting the poor and making the poor sell their kidneys to sick rich people.
Yeah.
How would you solve this issue?
Well, I guess my view is I let people decide what they want to do. And the current system we have now is that people who need organs desperately because it's a life-threatening situation can't get them because the price is set at zero artificially. So they sit on some waiting list. They all basically know they're going to die. Their families in vain try to cheer them up and say, oh, but something will come through, you know, and they drop dead in the middle of that sentence. But in a market, you would be able to say, well, look, I really need this. Well, I mean, I feel like if who on earth has the greater moral authority to decide what happens to your body than you? Is there somebody who has better authority than you?
Well, my answer to this is we're almost close to have the technology where you can have pigs with human organs and things like that. And the idea of having these organ farms for many people is regarded as like it's gross, it's dystopian, it's sci-fi in the worst way. But it's like, wait a minute, you're thinking it's a problem to have a supermarket where every sick kid who needs a lung or needs a kidney or needs a liver could just go to the store and be like, I want the pink one. And you could get it at like very cheaply. Like this is the dream. This is the goal.
And of course, if you had a child who was desperately ill and needed a transplant, I think you would have a different view of the question. You know, instead of trying to spin out dystopian fantasies, you'd say, what's the system in which my kid is most likely to be able to be saved?
Right, exactly. And at the same time, because right now what people do is they go to the third world and they have these kind of, basically they're evading market forces in America. So talk about exploiting, instead of exploiting poor people in America, if you use the word exploiting liberally, you're really exploiting people who are choosing between that next meal and death.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's in what they're regarding as capitalism at its worst.
And of course, in the richest, in the most capitalist societies, actually the poor suffer the fewest material deprivation. So there is actually, as this is easily demonstrated with the figures. So it's in the most advanced capitalist societies where the poor would be the least desperate and be in the least situation where they would feel they'd have to do that.
I remember I was talking to a girl who was a literal communist, and I was talking about North Korea, and she was insisting that as many people starve in America as starve in North Korea. And I'm like, I can't even last time I saw someone who was too thin.
Yeah.
And we went online and we found the numbers. I'm like, let's look it up.
Yeah.
And it was under 100 people, and all of them were like people who were held captive by like abusers, like, you know, like
right. So not a normal situation. Right. Well, can I just say one quick thing about the starving thing? I remember back in the early 90s when I was in college, I read a story that came out. In fact, I think Dan Rather even went on television and told everybody solemnly that it was somewhere between 10 and 12 million American children were starving. And you think, that can't be right. That just defies everything.
They're all fatties.
Yeah, well, I remember in the 19, it wasn't quite so bad in 91.
They're still chubby.
Yeah, right. That was obviously malnourishment was not the problem.
Right.
So where would they possibly get this number? So the Media Research Center, Brent Bozell's group, actually looked into it. And it turns out they were extrapolating from a study that had simply asked the question, did you go to bed hungry at any time during the year 1991? Oh. And if you said yes, they classified you as starving.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. These SOBs.
Actually, I was going to wait to take calls, but we got a call from Paris that I want to hear. So
that can't be.
Yeah. So is it Michelle?
No, it's Michael. I'm American, but I've lived here since 2002.
That counts. Oh,
okay, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I wanted to talk about everybody's favorite libertarian economist, Frédéric Bastiat.
Oh, yeah.
And something that's kind of interesting, maybe you're not aware of this, but basically, nobody in France has ever heard of the guy.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Well, let me explain.
Look up his Wikipedia page in English.
Yeah.
And then look it up in French and look at the difference in how long it is.
Wow,
that's fascinating.
Isn't that funny?
So I went to the equivalent of Harvard Business School over here. So many of my former classmates and colleagues, these are high level people with degrees in economics, and seriously, nobody has ever heard of him.
That is bizarre. Now, of course, in the U.S., people haven't heard of, major... I mean, most people haven't heard of Bastiat in the U.S. either, but a lot more than apparently have heard of him in France. And there's a whole French liberal tradition.
Do you want to explain who Bastiat... Do you want to explain the book and the fallacy?
Yeah. Bastiat was born, in the early years of the 1800s, died just, I think, in 1850. I don't think he lived to be 50 years old. But he was a tremendous economic journalist, you might say. I mean, he wrote great works, but a lot of what we really appreciate him for are his short little pieces where he gets to the heart of some problem. Now, what's best known...
He's like an Aesop's fable for liberalism.
He is. I mean, we should get to the Petition of the Candlemakers in a minute, but what he's best known
sir,
for...
Sir Tom, thank you.
Is yeah. the, well, just
thank
because,
you for hosting my show.
I just mean because it's a good fable. It really is outstanding.
Thank you, Tom. You want to switch seats?
Well, look,
I hosted your show, you could host mine.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, someday, right?
Yeah.
All right, so but the idea of it is that obviously if you have a baseball, you throw it through somebody's window and they break it, you're not helping the person because the idea is that doesn't help the economy because now the glass man has a job replacing the window. Well, duh, obviously if we burn this place to the ground, we put a lot of people to work repairing it. But if we didn't burn this place to the ground, if we didn't break that window, we would have this place plus the window plus whatever those people would be working on in the meantime.
Right.
So obviously, destruction makes us poorer, but a lot of people think, no, destruction makes us richer, or what is seen and what is not seen. Look, the government built this big baseball stadium. Okay, surely those resources would have gone to something else.
Right.
So you have to compare it not to a world without a baseball stadium, but rather a world with some other thing,
right,
which we now don't have. But
So the choice is, would you rather have a fixed window or would you rather have a window that was never broken and a sweater?
And a sweater, exactly. So the sweater is the net wealth that you now have. So then my favorite thing, though, is the Petition of the Candlemakers because it shows the problems with a lot of protectionist stuff. And I know, you know, not everybody agrees with us on this, but if you say something like, look, we've got a terrible competitor out there. It's given away free stuff, free light for everybody. And we candlemakers have to suffer against this unfair competition. And of course, we mean the sun.
Right.
The sun just gives the light away for free. So how are we supposed to compete against free? So we need a law to order people to shutter up their windows, keep this terrible competitor out, and buy more candles. Now, you see how preposterous that is, but that's more or less the logic of everything you hear that wants to impair trade.
So you consider yourself an anarchist, correct?
Yeah, I do.
You don't like using that term?
No, because it just turns everybody off, except the wrong people I don't in any way want to be associated with.
Who do you mean?
The SJW Antifa types who think they're anarchists because they smash a Starbucks window.
Okay, yeah. And then they lose the sweater.
Yeah, and then they lose the sweater.
Would you feel comfortable working for the government in any capacity then?
Oh.
That's a question I got on Twitter for you.
Yeah, that's a good one. if I did, I would. The thing is, the problem would be the salary, for one thing.
Right.
Could I take a salary? And part of me thinks I would donate the salary to charity. But that's not the same. That's still redistribution.
Right.
And I, at the same time, I can't chase everybody down.
And why is giving it to charity any more moral than giving it to a store that's producing a good of value?
Yeah, exactly. So, so I don't know. But at the same time, if I don't take the salary, the government uses it for clearly evil purposes. So I don't know. I have to think about the salary question. But I could see doing it as long as everything I did was dismantling something bad. What would be the moral problem with dismantling bad things?
Maybe you're validating the good things. Maybe you're validating the good things, right? Like you're saying, I'm taking apart this bad stuff. That means by extension, everything that's left is good.
Yeah. Well, okay. But what if I said that as a caveat? It would be like the Ninth Amendment. Just because we haven't listed something in the other nine amendments doesn't mean that you don't have that as a right. So the Ninth Amendment basically says, you know, you have the right to guns and free speech and assembly and everything. And if we forgot something, you also have that right too.
How's the Ninth Amendment working out for you?
Well, so yeah, but my point would be, I would be the believable. I would say, I want to abolish everything, and anything I didn't get to is only because I didn't have time.
Okay, that's fair. I got another question for you, which I think is very interesting. Do you think there is something inherent in Christianity, because you're a Catholic, that went hand in hand with how much Western Europe brought to civilization as opposed to other faiths?
Yeah, I think there are a bunch of things. Now, there are a bunch of things that can be exploited and twisted and used in extremely destructive directions. So there are a number of heresies that were very that led to communism, I think, or at least you could see an inspiration for communism in them.
But like what?
Well, for example, people will say the early Christian communities practiced property in common. And they would say, therefore, property in common is the best system for society. But there's nothing in that account that says any of this was coerced or anything but voluntary. So if people want to have a voluntary community where they share things, go ahead and do it.
Right.
But there's no suggestion that everybody needs to live this way. And the idea of private property is obviously taken for granted in the Ten Commandments. How can you have stealing if there's no property rights? But I wrote a book called How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization. Right. So I went through and tried to talk about, for example, just the one insight that you get from this is a deuterocanonical book according to the Protestants, but from the Book of Wisdom, Wisdom 11:21, God has ordered all things according to measure, number, and weight. This one verse had so much exegesis done about it over the centuries, from St. Augustine all the way up to the cathedral school at Chartres and for centuries after. And what they all took from that was the universe is built on mathematical relationships, and that when we study it, we should expect to find these patterns. And
that's the scholastic view.
Yeah, and of course, that is really helpful for getting the scientific enterprise going. So for a long time, people thought, well, science and faith are obviously at odds, and anybody who thinks otherwise is just some idiotic apologist. But actually, the modern scholarly consensus now in history of science departments is that, yeah, there's more to it than we once thought, precisely because if you have reason to doubt that the universe is orderly, then you can't even do the scientific method, because how could you do repeatable experiments?
There's this great – I read this two-volume book which came out, I don't remember when, at least 100 years ago, called The History of the Warfare Between Science and Religion.
Yeah, Andrew Dixon White, president of Cornell University.
I have a signed copy. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was only $50.
But that is basically considered to have been overturned at this
point.
Well,
no, but one of the stories in that book, which really stuck with me, is that he talks about how in some cases the religious people – it's not the stereotype they're just kooks, that they're actually thinking logically, but things aren't adding up. And the example he uses is with the lightning rods. So in every town, the church was always the one that was getting struck by lightning. And they could say fairly, what, it's a coincidence that in every town, lightning's always going to be hitting the church? Now, we know nowadays that it's a function that the church was the tallest, but that's not intuitive at all that the tallest building is going to be the one always hit by lightning.
Yeah,
why would that happen?
Right.
If lightning, since the Greeks or even earlier, was a sign of God's displeasure. So they were very against the idea of having lightning rods to burn down churches, because how is God going to tell you that he's upset? So it's not an illogical perspective. They were pointing to the actual death. They go, look, it's always hitting the church. How
right.
could that be
right.
random?
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah.
So there's a lot of these. How would you say that book's been overturned, though?
Well, the idea that it's simply and clearly a warfare,
right?
Because the title is the warfare between science and theology in Western civilization, and these days, like for example, I said this on Molyneux's show, but there's a company that sells courses from various universities called the Great Courses. They find the best professors, they record their courses, they sell them. But they are not libertarian or liberal or conservative or anarchist or socialist or anything. They just want to sell courses. Yeah. They want to be as plain vanilla as possible. So when I bought their History of Science course just to see how universal is this view that now actually – it's not so obvious that the church was just this implacable foe of the sciences when even the Great Courses professor is saying, yeah, we pretty much don't buy that anymore. Because if it was part of a general Enlightenment prejudice that everything before the 18th century that wasn't in some way touched by free thinkers was backward and superstitious. Well,
and we saw something similar with the modernist movement in the early 20th century, yeah, where everything old is bad and now we're going to change everything and be right, start from scratch.
And so when you actually go back and look, you find in discipline after discipline that actually, for example, like, you know, Rothbard was very fond of this, and Hayek was a big fan of Rothbard's essay on the prehistory of the Austrian school. Rothbard said, really, the first – and Rothbard just following Joseph Schumpeter, who wrote The History of Economic Analysis – posthumously published in the 50s, in which he said the first people who really talked about systematically prices, wages, monopoly, value, labor were not Adam Smith and his friends, but rather the 16th century Spanish theologians at the University of Salamanca. So whether it was economics or international law, the good kind, not the UN, just the idea there's a single moral code, right, that governs everybody. But then when you look at different branches of the sciences, I mean, Roger Boscovich was considered, who was a, we don't want to say Yugoslavian because that's a fake country, but he came from the Balkans.
Aren't all countries fake, Tom?
Okay, some are faker than others.
Okay.
Some are just invented by some jerk. But anyway, he was the
Is that a Hamilton reference? did invent America.
Oh, no. Okay. No. You are not hijacking your own show.
That's literally impossible.
But anyway, whether it was atomic theory or the study of Egyptology, Father Athanasius Kircher, or the first person to measure the rate of acceleration of a freely falling body was Father Giambattista Riccioli. I mean, just go on and on and on down the list. It gets harder and harder to say, well, these people just hated knowledge. The Jesuits brought the apparatus of Western science every day, went all over the world, continent after continent.
And even if you go to the ancient Egyptians where they thought that the sun is in a boat that's going across the goddess of the skies back every day, they still had astronomy down to a ridiculous degree. They had engineering down to such a degree, I think, I don't know now how they built the pyramids. It was something insane.
Right.
And the Great Pyramid was the tallest building on Earth, I think, until 1840, something crazy like that. So it's easy to say that these two things are warring, but sometimes they're, as Aquinas says, they're complementary to each other.
Yeah, and moreover, all you have to do in this case, as with in other things, is just open your eyes and look. I mean, obviously they coexisted, so something it can't be as simple as we think.
So another question I had on Twitter is, I wrote an article for The Observer called "The Case for American Secession," and the point of that article is America's never had one culture. That we've had two cultures, at the very least, two cultures from the very beginning, stuck together with staples and bubblegum. And after the Civil War, it's basically like, all right, this argument's over. And my point is, look, it's not working. Our cultures are increasingly disparate. We're self-segregating on social media and things like that. And you even have different – when I was doing my North Korea work, one of the things that Kim Jong-il in North Korea, when he met the South Korean president, found out was that after 50 years of them being separated, their languages were literally changing. Like, he could only understand 90% of what the other guy was saying, both in terms of accent and in terms of vocabulary. And we see that in the press where you can tell now, because it's so Orwellian, whether a reporter is on the right or the left, where they talk about tax increases, tax hikes, or revenue generation. And the language and the terms used are right now in real time becoming separated and segregated. And you see it with the Trump phenomenon where it's either he has colluded with Russia and this has been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, or there's nothing there. And there's nothing in between. Like, and people genuinely believe one of these two things. So my question I had for you is from Twitter, do you think this whole idea I have towards secession is going to be is the way to go for people who believe in freedom.
I think it has to be because, as you say, we're so different. And yeah, it's probably not reducible to just two cultures, but you can clearly identify the rough contours of two cultures.
Right.
And they are roughly geographically concentrated. So there's nothing precise about it. But we all know that there are some people who are inclined in the SJW direction and other people who just want to have nothing to do with it. That alone helps to define what's going on. I don't see how, as you say, I don't see how these things become compatible or we work out. If we could have worked out some kind of understanding between us that you've got your thing, we've got our thing, we'll leave you alone, you leave us alone, this would have been done a long time ago. It seems like there's, I personally, maybe this is my prejudice coming through, but I personally think it's the SJW side that will not leave the other side alone.
Right.
They have to invade their very thoughts. Maybe you've had an errant thought about some person or group or something that they hold dear, and they're going to come after you and destroy you over it. I don't see how we get to a point where we're just congenial and it all works out. And moreover, it's hard even to think of secession as working, even though I favor it, because secession would mean that one side is not going to get its maximalist goal, which is to be triumphant over all of us. If there's secession, one group is going to have its jurisdiction confined to one area. And if you have a universalist overarching goal of spreading your ideology everywhere, you can't be limited by secession.
Right, because there's that phrase, if there's injustice anywhere, it's a threat to justice everywhere.
Right.
Which, if you think about it for 3 seconds, is insane, because right now someone is beating their wife somewhere on Earth, and that's terrible, and I'm against it completely as you are, but it's not threatening me at all.
Right. And it doesn't mean that if you get a parking ticket and you go contest it, that the injustice somewhere else in the world is going to affect that in any way.
Correct, yeah. So we're taking calls for Tom Woods, 877-962-6846. When's the last time you did a call-in show?
I don't know. Well, I mean, I used to do a lot of radio, so we'd get a lot of calls on the radio. I remember my favorite call on the radio, I better not say whose show it was, because I've done a lot of big shows and I've done some small shows.
No one likes a show off.
Well, and yet here you have your own show. How about that?
You're welcome. So,
the guy called in, he obviously had not been listening to the show at all. He called in to tell the host that he was convinced that the elites of American society were sending secret code to each other through the political cartoons in his local newspaper.
Oh, gosh.
And now how they didn't – and at that point, the host boasted to me, you know, Tom, we don't screen the calls on this show. And I thought, you don't say.
Another question I had for you on Twitter is, what was the moment that made you decide to be a libertarian? Because you used to have some conservative tendencies.
Yeah, I know.
You're socially conservative, which is fine.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was definitely a paleocon in the 90s. So
what is a paleocon for people to...
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I don't mean to use this crazy lingo, but I mean, I like the paleocons. I'll just say that. In the same way that there are neoconservatives who are people who... Their fundamental worldview comes from the left, because a lot of the founders of it literally came from the left. And they left the left, so to speak, because they did not like the left's position on the Cold War. They thought, we've got to fight communism. And then, you know, some of them have some conservative tendencies on some issues. But by and large, they have this American greatness kind of Hamiltonian thing that's a really big problem.
Yeah, so the greatness is a problem that you don't have to worry about.
The paleocons were people who they deliberately came up with that term to distinguish themselves and say, well, we're the original old-timey conservatives. We're not interested in American greatness, which means 140 bases all over the world. It means the kinds of things conservatives used to value, which are limited, finite things like hearth and home, not remaking Libya or whatever. And so I kind of liked them, but they tended to be, you know, they were protectionist and they would have this or that thing they wanted the government to do. But by and large, they wanted to dismantle 90% of the federal government. So I was with them for a while. And so it's funny, even today, people will attack me for pictures of me in that day or articles I wrote. And they say, boy, some libertarian Woods was. Well, I already told you I wasn't a libertarian in those days, you jerk. I already said it. So what the heck was I supposed to do with this question?
At what moment did you decide?
Oh, yeah. So how did I get out of that, in other words? Yeah, how did I get out of that? Yeah. But I'll tell you, the answer was, I can give you a specific answer.
Please, that's the point.
But I mean, it's not like some vague, well, I was drifting. And I wasn't drifting. I read Hans Hoppe's book, Democracy, the God That Failed, and it made me feel intellectually complete as a libertarian. It answered a lot of the lingering objections I had. And just a year before that, I am ashamed to tell you, I had published an article in an academic journal called American Studies, and it was a kind of anti-capitalist article.
Oh.
Like right-wing anti-capitalist, you know?
Can we find that on TomWoods.com, the show notes?
No, you sure cannot. It has disappeared, and that is where it's going to stay.
On the memory hole?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that book I've read also. It's a very good book, Hans Hermann Hoppe, The Democracy, the God That Failed. He makes the case that monarchy is preferable to pure democracy. Now, he doesn't regard America as a democracy. No one does. We're a representative democracy. But he means it's better to have one guy at the top than mob rule. And he lays out the reasons for that. And he also makes the point, which I think people on both sides of the aisle are increasingly coming around to, that the idea that everyone voting all the time isn't always going to have the best results. And now people on the left are getting that, because if you tell them, hey, if you're for democracy that much, you get Trump. And then they're like, okay, wait a minute, we got to go back to the drawing board.
Right, exactly.
In fact, I was on Fox last night, Fox Business, with Dave Smith, and he made a comment. We're talking about Jeff Sessions, about how Jeff Sessions is behind the worst government program we have in this country. And I said, oh, you mean universal suffrage? And they cut it. They cut the joke.
Oh, that's a hilarious joke.
I guess, I don't know.
So you can say it on this show.
I can say whatever I want. So, yeah. So what do you think you've been working in this space for a very long time. What do you think have been kind of the bright spots, let's say, in the last 10 years in terms of moving the needle towards a freedom direction?
Well, do you mean like policies that have gone through our way, or just shift like in thinking?
Areas of hope.
Well, I guess areas of hope. Certainly at the time, I was excited beyond belief by Ron Paul, which is a kind of almost a plain vanilla response by now, because everybody says that. But it really was amazing.
You thought there was a chance he'd get the nomination?
I didn't necessarily think that.
Okay.
But I was amazed that many people supported him, given that he's basically saying we more or less have to start everything all over again. I mean, he's not sugarcoating anything. He's even coming out, if they have him on TV and they say, well, what's your view about the Civil War? And he would say, well, I think states have the right to secede. You're not allowed to say that. Right. And not one of his so-called handlers, which I don't think he really had, or if he did, he didn't pay any attention to them, would have supported him in saying that. And yet he would just give his honest answer. Or you'd ask him about the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and he'd say, I don't believe in forcing people to do things they don't want to do. And if that includes, putting them up in a hotel, then I don't favor that. I think there are peaceful ways around this that we have not exhausted. Now, you are. That is just death to your career. He didn't care. He just said it, and people followed him anyway. I thought, that's amazing. Now, no, not a million people. It wasn't like the Trump phenomenon. I mean, well, yeah, it was a million people, but you know what I mean? Yeah. It wasn't tens of millions, but the fact that many people were willing to go with a guy who, well, by his own admission, was not the most articulate guy in the world, but who just said what he thought was genuinely true and was unrehearsed and was saying radical things like end the Fed, bring the troops home, they're lying to you about 99% of the things that come out of their mouth. If that's not a bright spot, then we're holding the bar too high.
One of the most shocking moments, I think, for me in recent politics was when Ron Paul, this was, 2008, in the debate stage, he said with a straight face that the terrorists are here because we're over there. And he said this in front of Giuliani. And Giuliani basically had his appropriate meltdown. Yeah. And Ron Paul's just like, you know, suck it up, buttercup.
Yeah.
Were you there? Were you watching that? What was your reaction?
Oh, yeah, I was watching that. And I remember reading that Ron at the time thought...
Wait, just one more thing. And the audience...
Oh, yeah, they all love Giuliani. Nobody wants to hear the truth.
But it wasn't as 100% as you... I think they
really?
Got some cheers, yeah.
Okay, so maybe I've... But I remember at the time, though, he thought, well, this is it. I mean, the people are not supporting me on this. And then afterward, all the polls said he won the debate, and he realized this is actually the biggest shot in the arm he could have asked for. Right. Yeah, what was the most amazing thing about that? Yeah, Ron Paul saying things that don't get said on TV was important. But the fact that normally in American society, you say something you're not supposed to say, you know the ritual. You get solemnly informed. You have said something you are not allowed to say. We all know what happens. Oh, I am so sorry. I said it. I should not have said that. I didn't mean it. And you go through this ritual. It's like there's like a liturgical book, and then you get blessed with holy water. It's horrible. And he didn't do that. That was the amazing thing, that he actually doubled down on it. He gave more information in support of his position. And then the next day, he holds a press conference with the head of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, who says, yeah, Ron Paul's totally right about this. And then Ron's got a stack of books that Giuliani ought to read. I thought, now that is a hardcore guy.
Speaking of heads, you're a social conservative, but you're still libertarian. What was your reaction personally and politically to what Kathy Griffin did last week?
Well, you know, the thing is, it seems like the left does things like this all the time. So I was very surprised that this got that much outrage. I think what happened, I mean, I don't like it. I think it's stupid and barbaric looking, but and I also think even though people didn't like Obama, if somebody had been holding up a bloodied Obama head, we would never have heard the end of it. But what I think...
Understandably.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's just, why would you do that? But to me, it seems like what happens in American society is that you get this outrage snowball effect that when a certain number of people, you reach a critical mass of people who have officially declared this is not allowed, everybody sort of gets the memo, this is not allowed, time to pile on, and virtue signal to everybody that I'm not like Kathy Griffin. We need to be responsible and respect the office of the president. So I don't know which disgusted me more, the jerk-offs who were, you know,
jumping
on. I'm sorry, but I mean,
wow,
really. But just these people who, they're going to jump on board for, this offends them, but the Iraq war doesn't offend them. I am not interested in people like that.
Here's what I think happened. I think in the last 2 or 3 years, there's been an organized counter-revolution, especially on social media. And I talked to a lot of people on Twitter. I said, I'm shocked that people who defend Milo and lost all sorts of free speech, not that Milo's done anything even close to this, are jumping on the bandwagon with Kathy. And they all said to me, this is not about being offended. This is about calling them out as hypocrites and holding their feet to the fire. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, if you want to do that.
Right, because until the left is punished for things that they blame the right for, they're going to continue holding that whip and using that whip indiscriminately.
Yeah, so I mean, I
said on Twitter, she's a trial run and a soft target.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of about unforced errors. And if you're going to be taking down people at random, effectively, people say offensive things all the time. And if you can misconstrue any, you know, Governor Perry at one point during the debate said there's a dark cloud over America. And they said, well, that's racist. It's about Obama. It's like, what, dark cloud imagery has been around since the time immemorial.
Right.
And before we had any kind of president, even before our presidency existed, or the concept of a presidency. But if any word can be twisted into being proof that not just that you're wrong, but that you're malevolent and racist, well, it's time for you guys to have a taste of your own medicine. Because again, I thought it was just a dumb stunt, but she might be the first person on the left who knows what it feels like to be the victim of a Twitter mob this extent.
But then the same thing,
to the point of losing her job.
The same thing basically has been happening to Bill Maher because he used the N-word on his show.
Right.
And he's getting that thing of, in fact, Al Sharpton said, we can't just say, well, Bill Maher's our friend and he's a liberal, so therefore he gets a pass. Everybody has to be gone after who uses the wrong word. And I thought, well, it might be educational for Bill. Not that I support witch hunts over nothing, but it might be educational for Bill to see this is what, you know, who ironically, you know, would be the host of a show called Politically Incorrect.
Right.
Maybe he gets the sense of, well, gee, this is what it's like to live in America and hold unfashionable views. What do you think now, Bill?
Well, what was interesting is that when they saw they weren't getting traction with Bill, they went after Senator Sassy.
Yeah, why didn't you speak up in outrage in the 10 seconds of thought you had to put together a coherent
sentence? And
then to read his official statement, which was such a load of crap that there's no way in the world he was actually ever going to have spontaneously said.
Well, the point is, I said... his response demonstrates that the role of conservatives is to bow down and humor progressives in the domination because he's like, you know, I did the wrong thing. I should have been more outspoken. It's like, why are you letting the other side tell you what words you can and can't use?
I mean, from a strategy point of view. But the thing is, but also from a strategy point of view, I can totally imagine him thinking, why am I going to let Bill Maher be an albatross around my neck the rest of my career? I'm just going to get rid of this right now.
You don't think he legitimately feels that he did the wrong thing?
I think he feels like, well, I can't tell.
I mean, I think these conservatives are progressives at heart. And when he saw the backlash, he's like, I did the wrong thing and I have to make it right. Because
but notice, yeah, but when he saw the backlash, initially, well, he didn't walk out reproaching himself.
Well, because what happens is, I'm sure this is not a word he's heard a lot in this context. The audience laughs. He's talking to a comedian. So he's like, all right, I guess they know better than me.
Because
so
comedians obviously have a kind of poetic license.
And he's referring to, and Marr was referring to himself, of course.
Right.
So in that context, he's just going to go with the crowd, be like, all right, this is a hip LA crowd. I'm from Nebraska. Okay, if they think it's funny, ha 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 ha.
Yeah, yeah.
And
exactly.
He sees the reaction. He's like, okay, now I better kind of backpedal. But I think at base, he genuinely is one of these people who conservatives on one hand will argue against political correctness, but on the other hand, they'll be for it.
Yeah, no, they basically have internalized the whole thing. That's true. But my point is that I just don't think that in that moment he was thinking, well, I'm going to be in trouble over this.
Of course not.
I think he's thinking, well, you know, comedians say crazy things, and plus there are comedians who have said far worse things than that, probably saying them while you and I are sitting here all day long, every day. Who knows what they're ever going to latch on to say, now this was the unacceptable one, but these 27 other things are fine. And this one senator's got to stand there and be the policeman to figure out what's what. The whole thing's impossible to navigate.
Yeah, it was kind of funny to me because I had a similar vague experience where I was on a show and we were talking about North Korea, and I just mentioned how they're getting information because they're getting memory sticks from South Korea and China. So the North Koreans are learning about the outside world. And the host goes, oh, do they beat them with these sticks? And I just laughed because it was so like... First of all, it's not a literal stick. So I don't even know where to start with that, number one. Number two is like, you laugh because like, what do I do with this?
Yeah, right.
You know, it's kind of like a Borat moment. It's like you kind of like chuckle because it's like, I just want this moment to pass.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I bet it was like that for him.
Yeah. So that's exactly the look in his face. He's kind of confused and taken aback. My gut tells me, here's what else was fascinating about the Kathy Griffin thing. She said... And this is again speaks to how they don't get it. She said that Trump mobilized his army against her and that it was a mob mentality. And what the point I think people don't realize, especially people like her, is Trump is the consequence of this army. The army has been mobilized, especially on social media, because they see these stunt shows and shenanigans. They're wise to the tricks and they're like, I'm going to do something about it. And I'm sure you've seen this kind of with your audience as well, kind of people having that mindset, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. These people have only themselves to blame. And this is almost becoming accepted by everybody. I think even a few of them kind of understand when we take an entire demographic in the U.S. and we ridicule them and we pummel them constantly and we crap all over things they believe are sacred. And then all of a sudden, they rise up and say, you know, I'm tired of being treated like dirt and talked down to by, what, celebrities with an IQ of 65? You know, nope, not happening anymore.
Yeah, I think what the parallels are very close to, like, in an abusive relationship where at one point the wife's like, you know what, I've had it. I'm walking out the door, and in his head, he's like, I've been beating you up for years. Like,
what's changed?
Yeah. Doesn't make any sense.
Why would this happen now at this moment?
And we agreed that you deserve this.
Yeah.
And now you're all like, where's this coming from? From his insane point of view, it doesn't make sense because her role is to be kind of the one who's subjugated.
Yeah.
And I think this has been the case for decades in this country until very, very, very recently.
Now, it's not like, you know, I assume here I don't have to make the caveat that I'm not a big Trump supporter and all that. But even still, the fact is that these people that we're talking about, whether it's in entertainment or academia or whatever, all these elite people, their view is that we basically get our way. Yeah, you know, we'll let you elect a George W. Bush once in a while because he's very safely on our plantation. Oh, there's a word you better correct me on because that has to do with slavery. Or otherwise, if you're not outraged enough that I use that word, it could be trouble.
Thank you for telling me how to host my show.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so George W. Bush, okay, they're okay with that because they know that he'll basically do most of what they want in some, and that he's not going to stray that far. But generally, they get what they want.
But that's not, I mean, Bush got a lot of backlash. I mean, come on.
Well, that's right, but not like they're given to Trump. I mean, like now, just the other day, Bono has his arm around George W. Bush because you know, we helped stop AIDS in Africa when you were in office, and it's got 88,000 likes on Facebook. They're all saying, "Isn't that sweet?" They're not saying, "Wait a minute, that guy was a crazy mass murderer in Iraq." They don't even think that way.
Do you know about the Texas handshake, by the way?
Should I?
No. So George W. Bush, this is what a piece of crap he is. He would do something called what he called the Texas handshake. So he's like this big frat boy. He would eat like his barbecue and disgusting food. he'd have interns come into the Oval Office and he'd fart a lot and fart it up and, like, you know, have his arm around them and watch their face, like, after they have to maintain their composure.
Oh my.
While the President of the United States is stinking up the Oval Office. Look it up.
Well, there's an even worse story about Lyndon Johnson.
Oh,
well,
I better
not tell it with
the kids present.
I have a couple of my daughters here in the room. So.
Lyndon Johnson will often have meetings with his genitals out.
Well, that was what I was getting at, but I wanted to, you know, ixnay on the genitals, Jay.
Stay in school and stay off the pipe.
That's right. But anyway, what I want to say was that they always get what they basically get what they want culturally. Everything goes their way, and then now they've got Trump in office, who is not actually as radically different from them as they think he is. I mean, he is in some things. But now it's like, well, it's not like, well, okay, they're bound to get their turn, so we got to just suffer through it. It's, okay, it's the Russians. It's whatever will stick. This guy has to be driven out. I don't care if we have to pair up with the CIA, the international community, whatever we have to do to get rid of this guy. They can't just say, well, now it's their turn, because they don't get a turn, because we run this place.
What was fascinating to me, and if it wasn't, you know how people say Ayn Rand's books are unrealistic, which is partly true.
Yeah.
If she had put in her book that Bernie Sanders, this filthy old hippie, was going on TV and saying we should trust the CIA, I couldn't even begin to wrap my head without any irony. It's like, this is the one thing you guys are supposed to be for. Like, the CIA is against us and they're spying on us and they're ruining our lives. And for see him go on stage and be like, yeah, we should listen to what the CIA is saying. It's just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Any, I was wrong in the past, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, Michael Moore the same way. Well, you know, the CIA is reporting... Michael Moore, hello, do you remember who you are? What Michael Moore means? What the whole point of your life is?
We got a call. We've got Morgan from LA. Morgan.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, honored to be your first caller.
Second, but that's okay. Second comes right after first.
Oh, really? Oh, your fucking delay sucks. Hey, I have a question. I went from neoconservative to libertarian. Now I'm just like conservative libertarian-ish. Basically, I like Rand Paul. And it seems like...
You're the guy? You're that one guy who likes Rand Paul?
Yeah, I don't know why everyone else doesn't jump on the bandwagon. Like, no offense, but the true anarchists or libertarians are like furries. Just philosophy, nothing really putting in action. And you have one guy in there who's respected, kicking ass, not with everything, but it seems like everyone should just form behind him.
Well,
not just wait for the second coming of Buddha or... You know,
I don't think Buddha has a second coming, and my understanding is furries are all about the action, not the philosophy. So there's a few metaphors that are wrong here. I want to hear my favorite Trump moment. One of my many favorite Trump moments is the second debate. People forget about this. The first question goes to Carly Fiorina, right? There were 11 people on that stage, and they go, Carly, what do you think about Donald Trump and having his finger in the nuclear button? Because that was the big argument, just like with Goldwater, like Trump's just going to nuke people when they send him a mean tweet. And she gives this double talk out of both sides of her Botox mouth. Oh, you know, I like him. I don't like him. We got to support the what the people want, blah, blah. It goes, Mr. Trump, what is your response? And the first thing out of his mouth is, why is Rand Paul even here? He's at 1% in the polls. He's all the way at the end. He's horrible. It doesn't make any sense. That was the first. And that's when you're like, this is really happening.
And then
Rand Paul's like, look, this is the temperament we have and we shouldn't have this as a president. And Trump goes, I have a great temperament, believe me. And I've never made fun of your looks. And trust me, there's plenty there. There's a lot there.
Yeah. All right. So, on the Rand Paul question.
Yes.
And then, he was on Vice, and then he was getting all this great, restoring, ex-felons' rights and voting registration. And, he had a lot of momentum going. And then he just tried to be Mr. Conservative, and he took shit to bed. I mean, he was trying
Well, that's the whole point. That's why everyone
turned
on him.
That's why people, And plus, I don't know, I mean, is giving ex-felons voting rights a big priority of yours, Michael?
No,
it's not really
not.
On my list of 10 things.
Well, I'll give them the right to choose their method of execution. I think that's fair.
Well, I mean, look, on Rand, I think he's pretty good right now.
Thanks, Morgan.
I think he's done good stuff under Trump, and I think when really bad people have been, we've heard names floated like Elliot Abrams or whatever, Rand has said, look, I am not going to let this guy on. That's when he's at his best. But when he's in these Republican debates, he's just much too milquetoast. It's because I know what his I think I know what his beliefs are, and I think he feels like if he's too one way, then he's going to lose a lot of people. He will lose a lot of people, but he'll gain some excitement. Instead, he gained no voters and no excitement. Well, pick one thing and then just stick with that. And it's not a bad thing to be associated with your father. You shouldn't be ashamed of it or want to run away from it. Your father's why you're in the Senate.
Right. Right. Do you have any information? I mean, the big theory among all my friends is that he was kind of a Manchurian candidate, that he's going to posture as a conservative, and then when he gets in office, he's going to like let all drug users out of jail, things like that. Do you have any information? Was that kind of the idea?
I don't have anything that would verify that one way or the other. Okay. I mean, it's possible, but on the other hand, is there any evidence that that's ever happened before, that we've had a candidate who...
Ford in the pardon of Nixon.
Yeah, and then also FDR kind of ran a confusing campaign, which you could have thought he was going to be a budget cutter.
Right.
And then he really wasn't.
Right. So, yeah, he promised, he was yelling at Hoover for, you know, this is another big thing with libertarian history, is that people are saying Hoover is this right-wing conservative and FDR came and saved us from him. But basically, virtually everything FDR did has its roots in what Hoover did, who was very much a moderate, if not a liberal Republican.
Right.
So what do you think in the last 50 years... When people are taught about their history that they get wrong?
Oh, well, let's see. Oh, that's a tough one. Well, one would be I think people think this is true in a variety of regulatory agencies, but they think that we have some problem, then there's a government agency that's created, then the problem diminishes, therefore the agency caused the diminution. For example, the big example would be anti-discrimination law is why there are more blacks employed in different places and less black poverty. But the trends in black employment and income were already existing and were not accelerated by the Act of 1964. Same with Hispanics, same with Chinese Americans, same with Japanese Americans. Or if it's workplace injuries, yeah, there are fewer than before OSHA, but that was already falling before we got OSHA. Fewer accidents, but that was already happening. So people think they give government credit for more than it deserves.
And it makes sense. We even see it very recently where Breitbart always said that politics is downstream from culture. And you saw with Hillary Clinton and with Barack Obama, it's only when 50% of people in America were for gay marriage that they came out for gay marriage.
Yeah.
So the culture comes first, and right, then you have the laws and so on that follow. So same thing with the 60s and earlier. People were getting less and less prejudiced, and only then were politicians willing to stick their necks out.
Yeah, exactly.
What politician, a white politician in America, there's very, very few, certainly it's not going to be a majority, are going to stick their necks out for black people if it's going to cost them receipts. That almost never happens.
Yeah,
it doesn't even make sense, especially given how much more racist America was 60, 70, 80 years ago.
Yeah. So yeah, that's exactly right. Attitudes in society change and then politics follows.
One last question, then we have to wrap up. What do you think of this whole Brexit stuff? And do you have any thoughts on the British election?
Not so much on the British election because I've been vacationing and deliberately trying to avoid current events, but I'm all for Brexit, but yet I know that there's actually a group on the alt-right, and their view is that Brexit is bad because the European Union is in some way, even in an awkward way, it's like the white union of all white peoples. Why would we want to secede from that? Whereas my view is these are all creepy people, and you're darn right I want to secede from them.
The idea that if you go to some house party and everyone there is white, and that it's going to, like, this is going to be great, is demonstrably false.
Yeah, it's not so.
That's really their argument?
I've heard that. I've heard that said. Yeah, I mean, in fact, that's Richard Spencer's view about Brexit.
Wow.
Is that I'm not so sure how I feel. And the same reason that the alt-right is not so sympathetic to the Southern cause in the so-called Civil War. Why would we break up a big white country? You know, that's their view. So it's all wrong to say, well, the alt-right support. No, the alt-right supports you and your Lincoln views is what I would say to the left.
Yeah.
Yeah, not to you, okay, Michael Malice.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That is. I had not heard this, and I'm writing a book on the new right.
We'll talk about it, but I've heard alt-right people say, yeah, I read all these insults of Lincoln, that he was a white supremacist and a nationalist and anti-secessionist and a protectionist, and I think, hey, sounds like a great guy.
Okay, well, Lincoln's a great guy. We'll leave on that note. That's our time. I'll see you next Wednesday. Hope you learned something today. Thank you to Tom Woods. Check out Tom's free ebooks. What's the URL? I don't get it wrong.
Tom'sfreebooks.com.
Tom has a lot of great free ebooks that are very useful for people. So it's tom'sfreebooks.com, tomwoods.com. And I'll see you all next Wednesday. You're welcome.
That was Your Welcome with Michael Malice. Get the details at tomwoods.com/929. Also, I want to let you know about a blog and soon-to-be podcast created by a listener, and that is thelibertyparent.com. It is thelibertyparent.com,
And it's a site for all of you out there, like me, who have kids and they're in a non-libertarian world and they have questions and they have they're surrounded by points of view that are different from yours, and you want to know how to handle that, and you don't necessarily want to program your kids or brainwash them, but you do want to give them good answers to questions, and you do want to have resources for them. So these are the kinds of things that are going to be covered over at thelibertyparent.com. So I urge you to check that out. I'll link to it also at tomwoods.com/929. And I bet you he will get, he being Sean Warren, will get a nice influx of traffic, because I know there are many of you out there who could benefit from these resources. And of course, if you are planning to start your own blog, you can benefit from my resources, because I will give you promotion on my show, give you a link on my site, give you 24 free video tutorials to get you up and running really quickly, and optional membership in my secret bloggers group on Facebook, where we have hundreds of people there who all cooperate with each other, help each other, answer questions. It's a great support group. To get all these bonuses, all you got to do is go to tomwoods.com/publicity before you get your web hosting, and then you are all set. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.